For the first time, the UN will now have a UN migration agency. For the first time, they will have the global reach that we have, which is 10,000 people in 500 places on all five continents, which will give you a lot of ground truth and knowledge, plus the 65 years of experience as we've evolved with the migration issue. We have a $1.5 billion budget last year, and we use only $50 million, about 2%, to run the organization. And of the 10,000 people, we only have 300 at headquarters. So it's a very lean administrative structure, which I think stands in contrast to some of our sister agencies.
What are the key differences in terms of how you work and emphasis between the IOM and, of course, the UN's long-standing refugee agency? People will wonder, you know, migrants, refugees, obviously, they are often the same.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion in the public mind, and for understandable reasons. The way it works with the UNHCR-IOM relationship is that once the UNHCR has made a refugee status determination, an RSD, and there's a country that's ready to receive the refugee, normally the file passes to IOM, and we do all of the operational activities. All the medical exams, about 250,000 a year. We do cultural orientation for Australia, Canada, and the United States. We do the transportation, but we do everything that's required to get them to their new home. And that works very well. We've always had a good understanding. They're our closest traditional partner. But we go beyond refugees. Refugees are somewhat less than 10% of the 244 million migrants. So the other migrants are people like victims of trafficking, the sick and the elder on the move, pregnant women on the move, tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors, people going to join their families, students. So that all comes under our ambit, and we do that. We do lots of unusual things. We do out-of-country voting in order you have more political stability that way. We did the reintegration of the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. We've been asked to help with the reintegration of child soldiers in Colombia. So we do a lot of unusual things.
Are you also confident that there won't be any sort of inefficient overlaps, if you like, between the work that you're doing and the work that the refugee agency does?
Yeah, and there will be areas like, for example, internally displaced persons who, you know, we do a lot of, most of what we're doing, we have 200 people inside Syria, they're doing only assistance to IDPs. Plus, there's a lot of overlap with other agencies. We work closely with ILO on labor migration. We work with UNICEF on anything involving children, like the Colombian children I mentioned. What I think this will do, it will give us a greater coherence than we have at present, where we're sort of outside the tent.
And what fundamental difference do you think it'll make to the lives of migrants and refugees having the IOM now working within the UN?
Well, that is the key question. And if I had not thought that it would improve the lives of migrants, I never would have recommended this to the member states. But we think, for one thing, the voice of migrants needs to be heard in UN circles. And as it stands, it's fairly faint because we're outside the system. It'll also give us greater access to information, very important information on projects. To be very frank, it'll give us more access to funding because we're right now excluded from a lot of the multi-donor trust funds, and we need to have access to that. We're number five or six in terms of SURF funding. We get about 10% of the 300 million.
That's emergency funding.
That's emergency funding, right, the Central Emergency Relief Fund. So we get about 10% of that, about 30 million a year. We wouldn't be excluded from it, but it makes it much easier.
And will it make conditions easier in the field in practical terms? Now you can work within the UN family,
well,
so to speak.
Just on a very technical level, a lot of countries do not give us privileges and immunities. They either say or confuse us with an NGO, which we're not. We're an intergovernmental organization up to now. And so that will simplify it. And it will also clarify in the minds of people who don't know who we are, what we are. I think now that we're in the UN and now that China has joined, a number of countries will now look at us much more seriously in terms of membership. And we have 165 members now. I think we will get fairly close to universal membership in the next couple of years.
As you say, it's the biggest crisis in terms of migration and refugees since World War II, 65 million people mm-hmm. on the move. I mean, what benefits do you hope that they will see from this?
The European, what they call a crisis, was really avoidable. There were early warning signals, Lampedusa and so forth. And you know, if people have been in camps for 6 or 7 years, like the Syrians, they're going to eventually head north because they can't work and the children don't go to school. So I think all of that will now be much easier to manage together as a team.
And does there need to be greater coherence overall in terms of how the NGOs work with the various UN agencies in order to, you know, get the job done? Yeah.
Well, what we need two things. We need a whole of government approach, because a lot of governments, they run it out of a single ministry, but every ministry has an interest in migration. And we need a whole of society so that we bring in not only the governments, but bring in civil society, all the faith-based groups, and everybody who has an interest in migration, bring them all together around one table. We've tried to do it through the Global Forum on Migration and Development, but it's not a decision-making body, and it's been very good to have that. And we now can move even beyond that by being in the UN.
You said it, you know, in your address at the Refugee and Migration Summit that there was a toxic atmosphere surrounding the whole issue of refugees and migrants. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do we detoxify it, and how can the IOM specifically help with that?
Well, I wish I had the answer. But no, it's a good question, and I think there are ways to do it. What we need to involve the media much more. The media is really our friend. We need to involve the private sector much more, because they know where the jobs are. They do the training. They can be of a big help, and we've not engaged them enough. In addition to that, I think we've got to find a way, and we're doing it through several of our programs. I Am a Migrant. We have that project. We have a lot of social media we're doing now to let migrants tell their own stories, and to let the private sector tell the stories of the enormous contributions that migrants make, because historically, migration has always been overwhelmingly positive. This great city of New York, built on the backs of migrants, with the brains of migrants, and is still being done so today. And I said at one of the sessions here that if all of the migrants, recently arrived migrants in New York City, were to form a city, they'd probably be the third or fourth largest city in the United States. And the 244 million who UN has documented as being international migrants, they would be the sixth largest country in the world. Slightly smaller population than Indonesia, slightly larger than Brazil. So it's a big issue. It's a big factor in our life. But only the negative side is being told. And now you have the worst of all worlds, because those fleeing terrorism are being suspected of terrorism. And that's the worst part of the toxic narrative. We've got to show some political leadership on the question and help our people to understand that given the demographic imbalances between global north and global south, our societies are all going to become much more multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, multilingual. But if we aren't preparing our people for that, it won't go well.
Is there a danger that the international system overall might get overwhelmed as the flow of migrants just seems to be increasing year on year?
Well, that's, I think, a misperception of what we're talking about. If you take the UN figure of 244 million, it's still about 3%. Numerically, it's higher because the world's population quadrupled in the last century, but the percentage is the same. What we're having, though, is a greater percentage of forced migrants because of these wars. You have conflicts, armed conflicts, from West Africa to the Himalayas. If your child hadn't been in school for 5 or 6 years and you can't work, you're going to do something. You're not going to stay on the sidelines.
What's the greatest single challenge you face?
Right now would probably be to change the perception of migrants. If you can't change that, you're going to, in the end, constantly be fighting an uphill battle. If you can get back to a historically accurate narrative, that migration has always been historically positive, if you can get back to that narrative, then you can get a more sensible dialogue going. What's happening now is, rather than addressing the fears of people, politicians are capitalizing on the fears to stay in office or to get in office and to stay in. And right now, to be pro-migrant doesn't always win votes for you. So that, I think, is probably the biggest. That's why this whole question of our relations with the media are so important, and letting migrants start to tell their own story.
And your relations with politicians, obviously, in key states as well.
Exactly. And this is why we're always available to talk. I find that we have to spend more time, not only with the media, more time with the parliaments of this world. Because I think, generally speaking, if you can explain it to them, they'll understand how it can be managed, and that there are tools there to help you manage it. Under the SDGs of, I always say, SDG 10.7 talks about safe, orderly, and regular migration. How do you do that in an unsafe, disorderly, and irregular world? That's what we're talking about.